Starting Grid, die Formel-1-Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Ole Waschkau in Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de.
Keep racing
auf meinsportpodcast.de.
Einen schönen guten Tag und hallo zu Starting Grid, dem Formel-1-Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Mein Name ist Kevin Scheuren und es geht weiter mit unserem Interview-Dreierpack mit Matt Bishop, dem ehemaligen Kommunikationsdirektor von McLaren-Mercedes, McLaren-Honda, McLaren-McLaren und dem jetzigen Kommunikationsdirektor der W-Series, der reinen Frauen-Formel-Rennserie sozusagen, der uns eine Menge zu erzählen hatte. Wir haben ein insgesamt dreistündiges Interview aufgenommen. Letzte Woche gab es Teil 1. Könnt ihr euch gerne im Archiv nochmal anhören, dann ging es um seinen Einstieg in den Formel-1-Journalismus, über seinen Durchbruch im Formel-1-Journalismus, als er das doppelte Bremspedal von McLaren Mercedes aufgedeckt hat und seine Zusammenarbeit mit Emerson Fittipaldi. Heute geht es dann um McLaren Mercedes, seine Zeit vor dem Einstieg, seine Verbindung zu Ron Dennis und wir sprechen über einige Fahrer, mit denen er zusammengearbeitet hat als Pressechef, unter anderem natürlich Lewis Hamilton, Kevin Magnussen, Sergio Perez, Stoffel van Dorn, Fernando Alonso ein Stück weit auch noch. Also jede Menge zu besprechen, jede Menge für euch zu hören. Und wir steigen direkt ein. Christian Nimmervoll und ich führen dieses Interview auf Englisch. Und es geht jetzt gleich direkt los mit einer Frage von Christian rund um das erste Kennenlernen mit Ron Dennis.
Matt, you said you cheekily talk about Ron Dennis at times. So let's go to the time when you joined McLaren. As I believe it was from day one as head of communications in 2007, or actually 2008, but was announced 2007. How did it come about? Can you tell us about the first approach and the kind of history you had going on with Ron before? Because from journalist to team principal, you sort of had a relationship, of course. And so that's an interesting aspect to this story. Probably you can introduce us into it.
So my first contact with Ron Dennis was negative because it was around the subject of the famous second brake pedal Darren Heath scoop story, and Ron was not impressed. So I was probably a bad person or a persona non grata. But eventually the years rolled past. That had happened in 1997, and by 2001, it was only 4 years later. But by that time, Ron had decided I was a good thing. I think it was because the McLaren commercial operation, sponsorship operation, realized that my magazine, F1 Racing, was very important to the sponsors because it was the best-selling magazine by that time in the world, Formula One magazine in the world. And because of the brilliance of Darren Heath and other photographers, the sponsors' logos always look glorious in the photographs, and they just loved having it. Again, pre-digital. So you have to remember that a glossy magazine was exactly what the sponsors wanted in terms of activation. So Ron thought, well, here's this man, Matt Bishop, he's created this magazine, my sponsors love it, and he's maybe not such a bad old guy after all, he thought. And the whole second brake pedal thing had gone away. I remember having lunch with Ron in the McLaren motorhome at Manicourt in 2001. And just Ron and me having lunch. And I was a bit surprised because it wasn't an interview, but he said he wanted to have lunch. We had lunch. And he offered me a job. That was in 2001. It wasn't the right job. It wasn't the right money. It wasn't the right job spec either. Ron didn't understand the media, and Ron didn't understand, therefore, PR. And I think he just wanted in some way, Ron loves having experts. He likes having experts. He puts them on the mantelpiece. He polishes them, uses them from time to time, then puts them back on the mantelpiece when they're nice and shiny again for use at a later date. Anyway, I think he wanted to use me like that and to say, I've got the best PR person. And he wouldn't have minded paying quite a bit for it. I didn't want to have a boring job that was basically, you know, writing press releases and handing them out in the press room, the media center. And that's really what Ron saw. So he offered me that job. I said, thank you very much, but no. And then we continued, because he's not used to having people say no to him. I think he found that more interesting. And we ended up having dinner Grand Prix at motor races. Three, four times a year. Always just me and him. Very excellent wine, red wine. Excellent red wine, paid for by him, of course. And really fascinating. And somehow, even though we were very different people, completely different characters, completely different backgrounds, completely different jobs, obviously completely different wealth, he found me interesting. And then, and I think actually the fact that I was gay, he found rather interesting and exotic. I don't think he would have wanted a mechanic to be gay, but a man of letters, an editor, a senior journalist, yes, he probably found that quite exotic. Anyway, then we fast forward to 2007, when McLaren had an absolutely terrible experience, which was the famous Spygate, where Mike Coughlan, McLaren engineer, had been found in possession of 780 pages of Ferrari IP, technical drawings. It was a police matter, very, very serious. And of course, culminated in a $100 million fine for McLaren and exclusion from the 2007 Constructors' Championship, which otherwise they would have won. They didn't win the Drivers' Championship. That was Kimi Raikkonen for Ferrari, but Hamilton and Alonso scored more points than cumulatively did Raikkonen and Massa. So there was a Constructors' Championship lost and $100 million lost. And as this was happening towards the end of 2007, Ron used to ring me and say, what am I going to do? I say, Ron, I have to report this. You're asking the wrong person. You know, I have to report it. I have to ask my journalist to write about it. We are having, you know, Richard Woods of the FIA, who was the spin doctor, director of communications, working closely with Max Mosley, and Luca Colliani, who was the equivalent at Ferrari, working closely with John Todd. They are giving us off-the-record briefings all the time. You do not allow your PR staff to do that. You're in big trouble, Ron. There's no point asking me what to do about it. You haven't got the infrastructure to compete in this very tricky, murky world. So he was getting considerably worried. Anyway, in the Turkish Grand Prix of 2007, he rang me. He said, could you come to my office in the brand center, still the same brand center they use now, 13 years later. He said, can you come to my office? So I went to his office and he said, look, okay, I should have employed you before. Now I understand more about the kind of work you can do. We need a strategic communications director, not just a press officer or a PR officer. So I would like you to do that for me. And I suppose I thought to myself, well, I probably can do that, but I will be honest. I also thought, here is an opportunity to jack my salary from the journalist level to a different level. And I realized that Ron, well, there was a Venn diagram, really, if you can imagine three circles. And the three circles were the candidate to do that job for Ron had to be able to do it. So with all the right experience and expertise, understanding media, understanding PR, understanding Formula One and all its complexities. So that was already a very specific skill set. It also had to be somebody Ron trusted, because trust is so important to Ron and it takes him a long time to trust people. And he was in a nervous position around the whole issue of trust and mistrust. And it actually also had to be somebody he knew, therefore. So there were those three circles: trust, friendship, and expertise. And I realized, out of the 7 billion people in the world, those three Venn circles intersected with one person, me, by pure luck. By pure luck, it was just me. And McLaren's budgets were so high in those days, and indeed their protracted losses through fines were so enormous, that in a sense, the odd difference, which would make a massive difference to me, was not going to make a big difference to him. So I named a very handsome price. And the next race was Monza. We discussed it again. Ron loves negotiating. I said, Ron, don't bother negotiating. Just hire me. You know, time is of the essence. I have a notice period. Let's do this. No. He loves negotiating. So we negotiated more. And then the race after that was Spa. And we finalized. So it took us three Grand Prix meetings, wine, all the rest of it. And finally, we did agree. And I mean, my salary increase was, you know, very heavy. Much, much, much more than double. And which was obviously great. And yeah, so I started. I had to give my notice in and really worked out the end of that year. It was a bit tricky because Ron wanted me to start straight away. Haymarket didn't want me. They wanted me to do gardening leave because they thought the FIA would prefer that. Probably a mistake on Haymarket's part in actual fact. They should have just let me go straight away. But anyway, it was that was a bit messy, but eventually I started. My first official day was January the 2nd, 2008. But as you rightly say, it was announced earlier than that, probably about 3 months earlier than that.
When you say you negotiated with Ron at a couple of occasions over those two or three Grand Prix, was that purely about money or were there all the little details?
Ron loves details.
What kind?
You will sit on the plane. Will it be business class? Yes, for long haul. Will it ever be first class? Depends on how long. And then, you know, will it ever be economy class? No, it must only be business. All that business. Then there was the kind of things that I really didn't care about, but Ron thought were important. What type of uniform you will wear at the circuit. I mean, I could not care. I could not care at all. But, you know, McLaren was quite hierarchical in that way. So I can't even remember what the answers were, but that was part of it. My contract was 60 pages. And when I came in to sign it, which was on the Monday after, I still have it in my study here in London. I went into... and sat down with Ron and Tim Manane, who is the legal director, still there, a friend now. And we sat there and there were these 60 pages with RD, MB, RD, MB. We initialed every single page. It took ages, 60 pages. Very McLaren. McLaren was very like that. And the amount of detail you couldn't believe. Anyway, yes, money was the main part of the negotiation, but in the end, it included some other things. Well, also, I wanted to know how I'm going to be working. You know, how many staff I'm going to have? Am I going to be able to have the freedom to actually make a difference to McLaren's comms and PR operation? I don't just want to be earning a good salary, but sitting there like some emblem. I want to have some opportunity to make a big difference. And actually, I did have that opportunity because McLaren was in such a big post-Spygate hole that it was part of my job to help dig us out. And that's what I did really over the next few years. Amazing experience, absolutely amazing experience.
Ach, die späten 2000er, eine schöne Zeit in der Formel 1, nicht wahr? Wir machen jetzt eine kurze Pause und dann sprechen wir gleich weiter hier mit Matt Bishop über den Beginn der Zusammenarbeit mit Ron Dennis. Wir sprechen über die berühmte News of the World Story, die Max Mosley auch mit auszubaden hatte. und noch viele mehr, wenn ihr dranbleibt über Starting Grid, den Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Ihr hört Starting Grid, den Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Unser zweites Interview, beziehungsweise Teil 2 unseres Interview-Dreierpacks mit Matt Bishop. Ihr werdet jetzt gleich wieder eingeführt durch den kleinen Swoosh und dann geht's direkt wieder rein. Christian spricht die News of the World Story an, die Max Mosley damals so ein Stück weit zum Verhängnis wurde, erinnert euch sicherlich. Es gab einiges, was auch Matt Bishop da mitbekommen hat, was natürlich auch in Zusammenarbeit mit Ron Dennis sehr, sehr spannend war und sehr, sehr interessant, weil Ron Dennis und Max Mosley sich nicht schlecht verstanden haben, wenn ihr versteht, was ich meine. Also, weiter geht's mit Matt Bishop hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel-1-Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Weiterhin viel Spaß.
You've already mentioned...
Sorry,
you've already mentioned Spygate, Matt. There was the other thing in 2007, probably before you actually joined, but this battle between Fernando and Lewis. So it was really a highly interesting time when you joined. And also you mentioned that Ron's relationship with Max wasn't the best. I believe it was in 31st of March or something, because I remember we thought it was an April Fool at first. The Ron Dennis News of the World story. So it must have been an incredibly interesting
Max 3 months.
Yeah.
Max Mosley News of the World story. You said Ron Dennis.
Max Mosley, apologies. Yeah. So all these factors together with the relationship between Ron and Max, I mean, that must have been a fascinating first year.
Yes. I mean, during the whole of 2007, I knew Ron quite well already. You know, that's as I say, he had to know someone and trust someone. So the developing or the disintegrating relationship with Alonso and Hamilton, I was fully aware of. And of course, I was in Hungary in 2007 when, civil war was declared, really. And Fernando felt that he was on his own in a British team that was favouring a British boy. I don't think he was right about that, but that's what he thought. And if you remember, the qualifying at Hungary was very, very contentious because... Hamilton was delayed by Alonso, impeded in the pit lane for a while. Not long, 5-6 seconds, but enough in order to not get his lap in, but which finally at midnight, the FIA stewards penalized Alonso for. So he had to start farther back on the grid and there we go. And while that was happening, after that qualifying, but before the FIA stewards had made their announcement, was the famous McLaren meet the team session, which usually had 20 or 30 journalists. But on this occasion, there was every single journalist in the whole of Hungary was in the Brand Center ground floor. It was like a crowded underground tube train. People, no social distancing. It was incredibly tight. And we all got in. I was a journalist still. One of my last races as a journalist, editor of F1 Racing. And anyway, we went in and it was nervous, incredible atmosphere. And of course, Lewis wasn't there. Ron was there. Norbert Haug from Mercedes was there and Fernando was there. Suddenly, Lewis wasn't there. Actually, what Lewis was doing is he'd gone to the stewards to complain about Fernando. But of course, that wasn't something that was known. Even Ron didn't know that at the time. It was all so secretive at the time. Anyway, I remember, and this is, you may think this is a small thing, but this is absolutely how Fernando, who's so clever, realized he could put Ron off. So we all know Ron likes everything to be very neat. Fernando had a quite bushy beard at that point, and he arrived and sat down next to Ron with the juiciest peach you could ever imagine. And he just began to chew into the peach and let all the peach juice roll down his beard and the bits of orange pulp of fruit sticking to his lips and his beard and getting lodged in his beard.
Absolutely provoking.
And then he made these slurping noises, you know. I don't know if that can be heard across an audio podcast, but anyway, he made these incredible slurping noises. And it was all done deliberately. And Ron hated it, absolutely hated it. It was just a careful thing that Fernando was doing just because he could. Playing games. Fernando always played games. Very good at it.
Too good at it?
Yeah, maybe too good at it.
Okay.
Too good at it. Maybe Fernando would have had a world championship or two in the last 14 years. Of course, he has had two world championships, but not since 2006. Maybe he would have had a championship or two extra if he hadn't been quite so good at playing games at the expense of ingratiating himself to a team and team building. He would probably completely disagree with that. But you only have to look at what happens. He's as quick as anyone has ever been in a race car, and yet he never leaves a team on good terms, except the Enstone team, which is his spiritual return, which he always makes when he's caused trouble somewhere else. And that is what he will do next year.
Cause trouble, you mean?
Pardon?
You mean what you said, what he will do next year, you mean cause trouble or return to Enstone? I didn't...
No, return to his spiritual home.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay. You talked about Ron and this great story about Fernando sitting next to him. Ron liking it neat. I mean, everybody knows, but I guess you've had a couple of stories. I remember one that everyone's telling about is you don't have to wear shoes in Ron's plane. The tile floor in the garage. What else was there?
I remember hearing a rumor that Ron Dennis had the gravel, the stones at his private house where he parked his cars, laundered, washed every 6 months. And I thought, I'm going to ask him, is this true? So I said, Ron, is it true? Do you have the stones, the gravel in your drive, in your house? Do you have them washed, laundered every 6 months? He said, no, every 3 months. and that's Ron. That's Ron. You know, and he is utterly meticulous, utterly meticulous. I'll tell you another story about that, which is when in 2011, the McLaren Production Center, which is the factory next door to the McLaren Technology Center, in which the McLaren road cars are produced. And in 2011, we had finished building it and we were ready to start production. And of course, it was my job as director of communications to create an event that would be obviously reported around the opening of this new factory, but also that would place McLaren in a very prestigious place in terms of UK PLC, if you like, in terms of what McLaren was doing, not just in Formula One, in sport, but also for Great Britain, for the United Kingdom. So I remember saying to Ron, look, we need to get, if I'm going to aim high, Ron, I'm going to try and get the Prime Minister to come down and open the factory. He said, no, Prince William. I said, not Prince William. No, we had the Queen already. The Queen of England came down already to open the McLaren Technology Center. Prince William, you know, yes, he's famous and he's royal, but he's, you know, he's not as good as the Queen, and we've already had the Queen. We should have the Prime Minister. And then we are really saying something about McLaren, that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is prepared to give his morning up to come down and cut the ribbons and make the speeches. That will resonate with the business community and sponsorship community in a much bigger way. Anyway, he said, go and have a try. So in the end, cut a long story short, I did manage to get the Prime Minister to come just by lobbying at Downing Street and in government and parliament. And I had great, good contacts at that time. Still do, actually. And anyway, so once the Prime Minister had agreed to come, the Prime Minister's staff said, well, this is the speech that the Prime Minister will make. So could you make sure that what Ron says supports that? I said, of course, I'll do whatever you require. So they sent me the copy of the speech, which was all about repurposing the UK economy, moving away from service industries and financial service industries to manufacturing, luxury manufacturing, not making T-shirts, leave that to China, but, you know, cars and other luxury high-tech goods. And obviously McLaren could be in the vanguard of that, and that would be a strong message for McLaren to agree. So I wrote a speech, had to be exactly 15 minutes long. They said it must be exactly 15 minutes, can't be 14 and a half, can't be 15 and a half. This is the government people, because the security people have to know exactly where the Prime Minister is going to be to the second. So I wrote it to 15 minutes, and I said, Ron, I've written your speech. Can I read it aloud to you first in the right pace in your office? And then you must practice it a lot because you've got to read it well. And Ron isn't a great reader of speeches. Anyway, I went in and Ron said, make it exactly as it would be. Bring a lectern. Wear a suit. Do exactly the same dress rehearsal. So I said, okay. So I did that. And I stood 1 meter in front of him and spoke at the same pace with every smile and every frown and every pause as if you were talking to 400 people. And it lasted exactly 15 minutes. And then as I finished, you know, you finish such a speech with these words in order to trigger the applause. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. So Ron stared at me. He'd been reading the speech and listening to the speech for 15 minutes. Silence. He said, Matt, the screws on that lectern are improperly recessed. That was what he said. I said, oh, Ron, God, it took me ages to write this bloody speech. I don't know anything about government. This is a lot of work. We can fix the screws on the lectern. What did you think of the speech? Oh, no, okay. I just thought I'd mention it, Matt. But that's Ron, you see. Ron, absolute attention to detail. Not always the right detail, but absolute attention to detail, whether it's washing gravel, recessing screws on lecterns, or anything else. But I'm being unkind because Ron also does have an amazing ability in big picture thinking. And every now and then, Ron can be maddening. Of course, Ron can be maddening. Anybody like that can be. I'm sure Bernie Ecclestone could be. I'm sure Richard Branson could be. I'm sure, you know, Steve Jobs could be, anyone like that. And, but every now and then Ron said something that was so clever and you thought, oh my God, yes, that's absolutely right. That is right. That is what we should do. And that, I suppose, is why he built McLaren, because he was the one who built, yes, Bruce McLaren built McLaren in the first place. And Teddy Mayer took it on. But the person who made McLaren magnificent was Ron.
Interessante Persönlichkeit, dieser Ron Dennis, ne? Wie würde es euch da gehen, wenn ihr so einen Vortrag haltet und ihr bekommt so eine Antwort? Also vielleicht habt ihr das ja bei manchem Lehrer auch tatsächlich. Also irgendwie wirkt der Ron Dennis wie ein kleiner Oberlehrer. Ja, gerne eure Meinung dazu mal mit dem Hashtag StartingGridMSP über unseren Twitter-Kanal @StartingGridF1. Könnt ihr uns gerne folgen, auch in unserer StartingGridF1-Fans-Facebook-Gruppe ist noch Platz. Könnt ihr gerne auch über dieses Interview diskutieren und sprechen. Freuen wir uns sehr drüber, über euer Feedback. Und wenn ihr uns allen jeweils bei Twitter folgen wollt, @mst_christian, N für Christian Nimmervoll, @thebishf1 für Matt Bishop und @kevin_scheuren für meine Wenigkeit. Wir machen jetzt eine kurze Pause und dann geht's gleich weiter mit dem Interview mit Matt Bishop. Und dann sprechen wir unter anderem noch über einige Fahrer, mit denen er zusammengearbeitet hat. Könnt ihr euch drauf freuen, hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Bleibt dran. Willkommen zurück bei Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Unser Interview mit Matt Bishop geht weiter. Jetzt geht es gleich um Fahrer und zwar um weitere Fahrer, die bei McLaren Mercedes unterwegs waren. Dass Matt Bishop da war, Jenson Button wird genannt, Heikki Kovalainen wird genannt. Wir sprechen über so viele Sachen, die auch Teamdynamiken ausmachen und die vielleicht auch so ein bisschen darüber entscheiden, wer Weltmeister werden kann und wer nicht, aus der Sicht von Matt Bishop, dem ehemaligen Kommunikationsdirektor von McLaren Mercedes. Also weiter geht's hier mit ihm bei Starting Grid auf meinsportpodcast.de. Viel Spaß weiterhin.
When you ask him a question, like you said you asked him about the gravel, I mean, even the question already implies you think it's ridiculous. Will he be offended when you talk about that with him?
No. No, he wouldn't even recognize it as ridiculous. He would regard, because the alternative would be not to wash the stones at all.
Which would be ridiculous.
Which is what the rest of us do. We don't wash up. We don't mind. Our stones have got a bit of, you know, dropped oil on them and a bit of exhaust staining. Who cares? Ron would just think that was extraordinary. Ron looks at people's fingernails, not just women. He looks at men's fingernails. When he meets them in business meetings, he looks at their fingernails. And if their fingernails are not properly manicured, he's not very happy. He will still tell you that one of the reasons he thought that Jan Magnussen, that's Kevin Magnussen's father, was not an ideal McLaren driver, because if you remember, Jan Magnussen was arguably the best Formula 3 driver of all time and did have one race, I think, as a McLaren Formula 1 driver and might have had more. And until he was traveling with Ron and they got up to passport control and Jan couldn't find his passport and then realized that it was in his bag, the bag that you check in. And so he opened up this suitcase and Ron stared at the bag, which had underpants, toothbrush, none of it in a bag, in a separate bag, the toothbrush just in with the underpants and the jeans, the toothpaste in with the everything else, and the passport somewhere was finally found in between a pair of underpants and a pair of socks. And Ron just thought, nah, if you can do that, if you pack your bag like that, your mind is not well organized enough for me. And I think that was really the reason that it just put him off Jan Magnussen. It just made him think that his mind wasn't orderly. He likes an orderly mind, Ron.
So what we learn from this is that you should have a clean suitcase because it might affect your later Formula One career.
Absolutely right. And also another thing I will say is buy a lot of socks, because you never know, if you were at McLaren, Ron might suddenly say, I'm not coming to the office today. Please come to my house. And of course, then you had to arrive and take your shoes off as you walked in. You don't want a hole in your socks. Ron will. So, you know, spend more money on socks than you believe.
But isn't it interesting? Let's talk about drivers for a second. Isn't it interesting that during the Ron Dennis era, even later on, the drivers had a certain image that were driving for McLaren? They were all clean shaven. They were all very good looking, handsome men, if you can say it like that. The one exception might be Fernando Alonso in 2007, who was a little bit rugged and a little bit, at the end, he was not really caring at all.
But he was completely like military at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. He was clean shaven at the beginning. No.
At the very beginning, if you look at that, if you remember, perhaps you went, I certainly went, to the launch at Valencia at the beginning of the 2007 season. I mean, yes, Fernando Alonso looked like a Spanish soldier, you know, with an absolute short haircut, completely carefully shaved. Lewis Hamilton, of course, as well. And they all did, as you say, that David Coulthard and so on. But I remember when David, having been at McLaren for 9 years, And then he joined Red Bull. And the first thing he did was stop shaving. It was the first thing he did. And, you know, obviously Lewis now, if you look at a picture of Lewis in 2007 compared with now, it's a different man. I know it's 13 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a completely different man. I don't have any problem with the way Lewis looks. I think he looks great. But I'm sure Ron probably doesn't.
I mean, you could go through the ranks. You have Hamilton, Kovalainen, and Button, Perez, Magnussen, of course, Stoffel Vandoorne, and the second coming of Fernando Alonso, who could be a man, you know what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Heikki Kovalainen, a little bit humorously obtained a few weeks ago when a certain Amazon Web Services and Formula One did a ranking. And there were so many drivers in the top 10 of the pure pace fastest drivers in 70 years of Formula One racing. And there were two men who people might have not expected in the top 10. One was Jarno Trulli, and the other one was Heikki Kovalainen, one of the fastest drivers on pure pace in Formula One history. Would you agree on this position in the ranking?
Of course not. I think, you know, both Heikki and Jarno, by the way, I'm in contact with both of them. I worked with Heikki and I got to know Jarno quite well. In fact, I had quite a long email exchange with Jarno, you know, only in the past few months. But they both had something in common, which was very strong qualifying pace. Not so much racing pace. They would not like to hear that, but their qualifying pace was legendary, really. If you think that Heikki often was as quick or sometimes quicker than Lewis Hamilton in 2008, particularly 2008, not so much 2009 when the car was getting away from him and Lewis had learned how to drive round a at first not good car. But Heikki was just naturally quick in qualifying. Perfect teammate, by the way. That's what you want. I personally believe you want your number one driver to be a number one. You don't want to operate team orders, but you want your number two driver to be extremely quick in qualifying because it keeps your number one driver honest and always looking for extra pace. But then you also want him not to get in the way of your number one driver when it comes to Sunday.
Why?
So,
yeah.
Because you want your driver to win points. You don't want them to shunt each other. You don't want the wrong person to be winning races. To me, that is the absolute optimal number two. Very quick in qualifying, not quite so quick in the race.
What?
If you look back at history, that's often how championships have been won. And often they have not been won when the two number ones have got in their way or shared the wins.
Why are Finnish drivers the best number two drivers in Formula One history? I mean, if we look at it, David Coulthard had a chance to capture the team just for a slight window. He could have had the chance, but he didn't.
Well, I don't think it's a Finnish thing because I think Finnish drivers are also among the best number one drivers. You know, I think, you know, Häkkinen, I would put up with the legend status. But what I actually think is that you put your finger on something I think is very interesting. And I think Coulthard and Giancarlo Fisichella are examples of this, which is if the car is good enough for P9 in qualifying, they will give you P9. They might give you P8. And then they'll race it really well. But if the car is good enough for P1, something in the brain will go slightly different and they'll give you P3. And if you think about Coulthard, that's what happened. When the car was a midfield car in 95, 96, he was usually ahead of Häkkinen and through to 97 as well. And then when the car was good enough for P1 in 98, David didn't even see which way Mika had gone. Mika was utterly dominant. And we saw exactly the same thing a few years later with Fisichella, who had been extremely good in mediocre cars, scoring points and the occasional podium in Jordans and so on, and the odd Benetton. And then when the Renault was a championship-winning car, he could still do the podiums, but he couldn't live with Fernando, who did all the winning. I think there's an interesting thing around that, and I don't exactly know what it is. It probably needs a sports psychologist to dig it out, because those two drivers were different types. David Coulthard, very much a thinker, and Giancarlo Fisichella, not so much of a thinker. But nonetheless, they were both brilliant in midfield cars, and something, the last tenth, was missing somehow when the car was good enough for the championship.
Was the pairing of Lewis Hamilton and Jenson Button as easily manageable as it looked from the outside, from the inside?
Jenson Button is a very clever guy. Jenson realized that in order to do well against Hamilton, and by the way, he did, you know, he did do well. In the three seasons, he actually scored more points than Lewis. I know there's reasons if you analyze it, but however you analyze it, you'd have to say that Jenson did a good job and won races and so on and stacked up well against Lewis Hamilton. And we all know how good Lewis Hamilton is. So he did do that. One of the ways he did that, I mean, Jenson is very good at playing games without it being obvious that he's playing games. Fernando plays games and makes it very obvious he's playing games and enjoys that. Jenson wants to show that he's everyone's mate, get the team on my side, be really, really nice to all the marketing people, really nice to all the cooks and cleaners, really nice to all the PR people. By the way, this is part of being a racing driver. If you can't do this, you're not doing your job right. Fangio was brilliant with his mechanics. And that's one of the things that a proper racing driver should not ignore as an important part of his skill set. But anyway, Jenson was particularly good at it and very careful at making out that he wasn't really doing it as a tactic, but he was just doing it as a natural bit of friendliness. Lewis, not so good. Also, Lewis was going through some difficult times at that period. You know, he was sacking his own father as manager. Not easy. Not an easy thing to do. Whereas Jenson's connections were all friendly and relaxed, and he loved having his dad around. And in that way, it was quite good. I think Lewis will always make a team's life a little bit trickier than some other drivers because he's a genius. But I never complained about that because, you know, if we were making a movie in the 1950s in Hollywood, would we want James Dean and Marilyn Monroe in our movie? Answer, yes. Why? Because it would be a blockbuster success if we had those two superstars. Would they be the easiest people to manage on the set? No, they'd be very, very difficult. The makeup girls and the camera people would be saying, no, don't have them. They're a nightmare. But we'd say, yes, we will have them because they would make the film a success. By the same token, if you have a Formula One team, you should move heaven and earth to have Lewis Hamilton driving your car. And anybody who doesn't think that doesn't actually understand what matters in motor racing. You want the fastest driver available, and then you hire good people and pay them well to cope with that brilliant driver's insecurities and oddities.
Eine Pause machen wir noch hier beim Interview mit Matt Bishop, dann geht's gleich im letzten Abschnitt um Fahrer, die es nicht geschafft haben bei McLaren Mercedes, unter anderem Sergio Perez und Kevin Magnussen. Auch das fand ich sehr, sehr interessant, weil er da seine ganz eigene Sicht auf die Dinge hatte. Und wir kommen so langsam Richtung Lewis Hamilton. Das wird natürlich nächste Woche noch ein weiteres großes Thema sein. Aber gleich erstmal noch der letzte Teil von Matt Bishop hier bei uns bei Starting Grid auf meinsportpodcast.de. Also dranbleiben. Ein letztes Mal sind wir zurück hier bei Starting Grid, den Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Kevin Scheuren hier immer noch für euch mit einer kleinen Anmoderation für den letzten Abschnitt des zweiten Teils unseres Interview-Dreierpacks mit Matt Bishop. Es geht jetzt unter anderem um Fahrer, die es nicht so wirklich geschafft haben bei McLaren Mercedes, warum das der Fall war und was vielleicht hätte besser laufen müssen. Und wir sprechen über etwas, das McLaren damals gemacht hat, das nennt sich Toont. Vielleicht erinnert sich der eine oder andere von euch noch. Sehr, sehr coole Comics, die unter der Federführung von Matt Bishop gelaufen sind. Wie es dazu kam und warum das Ganze aufgehört hat, das hört ihr, wenn ihr jetzt gleich dranbleibt hier bei unserem Interview mit Matt Bishop, dem ehemaligen Kommunikationsdirektor von McLaren Mercedes und dem jetzigen Kommunikationsdirektor der W-Series, der ersten reinen Frauen-Formel-Rennserie im Motorsport. Also viel Spaß und bis gleich.
We will get to Lewis in a second.
Ladies do now.
We'll get to Lewis in a second. Two drivers that I want to ask you about that didn't make it at McLaren when you were there, who had high hopes when they came to McLaren, who were critically acclaimed as good drivers, as fast drivers, and you know who I'm talking about now. It's Sergio Perez, for one, and Stoffel Vandoorne, who was brokered as one of the most talented drivers Formula 2 or GP2 has ever seen coming to McLaren. Why didn't it work out for those two especially?
Well, and you could add Kevin Magnussen to that.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I think that's an interesting... Let's talk about those three, if you don't mind, because I think those three are quite interesting. I think McLaren isn't an easy place. I worked there for 10 years. It isn't an easy place politically. It wasn't then. It probably isn't now. Doesn't mean it isn't a brilliant team, or it wasn't a brilliant team, because it was and may even still be. But it wasn't simple and easy. And there were some drivers who realized that. Some drivers who realized, I don't think this is ever really going to suit me, and therefore I don't want to drive for McLaren. I remember Fisichella telling me that once. I don't think it would ever suit me. And he's probably right. Anyway, the types of drivers who thrived there were usually ones who, usually not always, either extraordinary talents, Senna, or extraordinarily psychologically robust. Now, that may be an odd word to use about people like, I mean, Häkkinen and Raikkonen, for instance. Genuinely didn't care. You know, Häkkinen would not care that he was seeming boring in a press conference. He just wouldn't engage with that. He'd say the minimum that he needed to say to a sponsor. He would focus on what he needed to do to win races and championships. Raikkonen genuinely didn't mind. Again, if you said to him, I never worked with him in the team, but if you said to him, you know, you need to improve your PR image, he would just stare at you, uncomprehending. So in that sense, psychologically robust, in other words, not upsettable, not easy to upset. Lewis was easy to upset, but then he was a genius, super quick. And after all, you have to say, he has had the majority of his success, of course, outside McLaren. So even he did find it difficult in McLaren. Jensen was the finished article when he arrived, very successful, already a world champion, very well sorted out support systems with father, manager, so on. Anyway, let's go to these drivers. So Checo Perez, I mean, Checo Perez was not necessarily the absolute first choice at McLaren at the time. If you recall, Lewis had left for Mercedes, which had felt a bit like a divorce. You know, McLaren had invented Lewis Hamilton, had brought him up from a boy, had paid for everything. Lewis and McLaren seemed at that time inseparable. I know it seems hard to imagine that now, but that's how it did seem. And inside the team, it felt like a betrayal in a way, or certainly like a divorce. So who could we get? There was talk of various drivers, Heidfeld. There was talk, I think, of Kubica. There was talk, I can't even remember. Perhaps you remember better than I. I was there, but I can't exactly remember. But in the end, we went for Perez. But it wasn't exactly certain that it was the right decision, or that everybody within the team was happy with it. And when he arrived, it was obvious that he was going to struggle with the McLaren culture. I think Checo has shown himself to be a good driver since then. but in a far more friendly place. Anyway, he had a very difficult year. He sometimes showed real pace, sometimes quicker than Jensen, who of course was a world champion. But he was obviously not happy. And I remember, I think it was in 2014 when he'd already left McLaren. And I bumped into him after the race in the hotel, the Sofitel in Bahrain. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think he'd driven well and he was on the podium. And I saw him, of course, I knew him, having worked with him for a year. And I said, well done, good drive, mate, well done. And he went, just made a kind of heavy breathing noise, big sigh. I said, it's lucky we sacked you, wasn't it? And he went, yes, yes, so lucky, so lucky. And in some ways, I think that was right. Anyway, we did, of course, discontinue him and replace him with Kevin Magnussen. And Kevin Magnussen couldn't have had a better start to his McLaren career. You know, he finished on the podium, his very first Grand Prix. Not many people in the history of the sport have done that. And then it was many, many, many years before McLaren got any podium with anyone again. 4 years, wasn't it? 5 years, something like that. Anyway, he started fantastically, and people, I remember people thinking, we're back. The car's good. We know Jensen's good. This new quick kid has stuck it straight on the podium. Fantastic. But it didn't work out like that. And I think McLaren expects its drivers to be the finished article and doesn't really have that much infrastructure. Perhaps they do now. Perhaps they do, for instance, with Lando Norris. So I'm not criticizing the team now because I don't know the team now. But when I was there, a rookie like Kevin, who was an absolute rookie, probably didn't have the support systems among engineers and so on to assist him from a technical point of view. And he was ranged against a world champion, hugely experienced and much quicker than most people give him credit for, Jenson Button, who in the nicest, politest, friendliest way played the games in order to make sure that the team saw him, Jenson, as the better choice. And Kevin, and nice and promising, but not the one to keep.
How would you do that, Matt? Be nice and play games?
Well, he would... Look, he was very good. Don't get me wrong. He was very, very good. He was always good in the debriefs. He was always good with the marketing and the PR. He was always very good with the very senior people like Ron and Mansoor OJ and the Bahrainis. He also made sure that his dad and his manager were completely, you know, part of the operation in that sense, and that he therefore provided solutions rather than problems. And there was little Kev on his own. He had a manager that he was falling out with, Dorda Reese Madsen, a manager that he had done a good job with him in the World Series by Renault 3.5 and so on, which he'd won. But they were falling out. He was kind of on his own. He was kind of on his own, a bit of an island against, you know, Team Button, which was a very well-grooved machine. And Jensen was very smart as well and friendly with Kevin. And they genuinely liked Kevin. Kevin's very likable. And he wouldn't make Kevin think that, in fact, he was doing a number or playing a game, but he was, because that's what a Formula One driver should always do. That's what Fangio did. That's what everyone's always done. You have to do it. But Kevin probably didn't recognize it or didn't recognize it until it was too late. He didn't do anything wrong. And but for the fact that for some unknown reason, Ron fell in love with the idea of rehiring Fernando, which is a grotesque error and a huge waste of money. 4 years, $40 million a year, $160 million, complete waste. Anyway, but for that, then Button and Magnussen would have continued on into 2015 and so on. But it wasn't to be. the Fernando Part 2 chapter arrived with grave negative consequences for McLaren. Not quite as negative as Part 1, but not far off.
And Stoffel?
Stoffel, right?
We have to talk about our Stoffel. He's one of our heroes here in our podcast.
Yeah, he's like a podcast legend.
He's not only a podcast legend, he has the van boost every single week in Formula E. Who can say that about him?
I'm a big Stoffel van Dorn fan. In fact, it was I who introduced Stoffel to McLaren.
You did good. You did good. Good for you.
My best friend in the sport is Alex Wurz. Alex Wurz and I are very, very good friends. You know, we WhatsApp many times every day. And we have been friends for, you know, more than 20 years. Anyway, he was the driver coach in the FIA Foundation Young Driver Academy at that time. And I remember having dinner with him at one of these races, a Grand Prix, and saying, so tell us about the academy. Have you got any good young drivers there? He said, I can't say. I can't say because you work for McLaren. I'm not allowed to say if there's any good ones. I can't tell a team that. I said, oh, Alex, just tell, you're not telling a team. You're just telling your old mate. You're telling me. He said, yes, but you work for a team, you idiot. I said, well, I know, but, you know, have some wine. So we had a bit more wine. And then he said, look, okay, I'm not going to use a name, but there is one young Belgian. So anyway, taxi back to the hotel, straight on Google, fingers crossed, I hope there's only one Belgian in the FIA Young Driver Academy. And there was only one Belgian, so I knew it was Stoffel. So then I started watching Stoffel's results, knowing that Alex thought he was the best of that group. And then later I said, I mentioned Stoffel and to Alex, and he kind of realized that I'd worked it out in that way. So by then we started talking a bit openly about Stoffel. And then I don't think it was Spa, his home race. I think it was Nürburgring, which is very close, of course. And Alex borrowed a pass and brought Stoffel, when Stoffel was young, 18, you know, and he said, could I bring him to the McLaren motorhome and brand center and meet you and meet others? And so he did. And I met Stoffel van Dorn for the first time. And he seemed, you know, that very organized, quite quiet, but he was only a teenager. And I thought he was very, very good. And I remember telling Sam Michael and Phil Prue, both of whom were senior engineers at McLaren at the time, not anymore, of course. And we all started looking at Stoffel. And I said, Stoffel, can you do me a favor? After every single race, can you start sending me a report, a proper tabulated report, qualifying, race, tires, engineering, mistakes, things we could have done better, lessons for future races? Anyway, he started doing it. It was in my inbox at 9 o'clock every single Monday morning. And by the end of, after about 6 months of them, they were word processed as precisely as if a brilliant secretary had written them. And they were as full of engineering expertise as if an engineer had written them. They were magnificent. And he continued to do them for year after year after year, right the way through to GP2. Still sending me this report, which he knew I was then sharing with Sam and Phil. And then Andrea Stella, others began to say, can I have them? Can I have these Stoffel van Dorn reports? Martin Whitmarsh. And in the end, it became well known. And I said, and it's something I've always recommended to young drivers, do that. It will be something that will separate you from the crowd and make people be impressed. Anyway, certainly did with Stoffel. And I think, don't forget, I think Stoffel's performance in GP2 was fantastic. You know, one of the great, great championship wins. He completely dominated that season. I mean, he nearly beat Kevin in Formula Renault 3.5 the year before, despite the fact that he was a rookie in it and Kevin was in his second year. Anyway, you know, very, very good driver. But then he got to McLaren and he was up against Fernando Alonso, who is fantastically quick and very political and openly plays games. And he was up against something else as well, he was up against the fact that it's, and we all know this is the case, that really, Zak Brown really wanted Fernando Alonso and got on very well with Fernando Alonso, yes. But ultimately, the person Zak Brown wanted in the other car was Lando Norris. And it, there really wasn't enough loyalty to share around among those three. I'm not blaming Zak. There are only two drives, and there were three drivers. So ultimately, I think Stoffel had his 2 years there. Towards the end, he could tell he was demotivated. I wasn't in the team anymore, but he was demotivated and confused. And you just, there was an inevitability about the fact that he would be out-qualified and out-raced by Fernando every time. And Norris was waiting in the wings. You know, eventually started doing FP1. I think everybody saw it inevitable. And therefore, Stoffel drifted out of Formula One, which I think is a great pity because I think he is properly talented. And, you know, he may never find his way back in, but he'll certainly, and is already finding himself a good career. And who knows what the future will hold in terms of the relative seniority of Formula E and Formula One anyway, in time.
Before we move on to talk about why we actually got you into this podcast, which is mainly about diversity and Lewis, I need to go through one little story about your McLaren years. I remember you had this funny, great video series Tuned going on.
Yes.
Whose idea was it? And who convinced Ron Dennis to do this? Because this is so not Ron Dennis, is it?
So Tuned was the brainchild of John Allott, who is not very well known in Formula One circles, but worked for McLaren for 13 years between 2007 and this year. He's just left. And he was a senior person, marketer, brand and marketing director. I think, I don't know what his job title ended up being, but basically he was a brand and marketing director. Good friend of mine. We worked closely together, really clever guy, not a racing guy, a brand and marketing guy. He hadn't come from a racing background. He'd come from a company called Interbrand, where he was chief executive. Australian, by the way, but living in England. And he cleverly thought of Tuned for two reasons in a nutshell. One was that it would open up the McLaren's storytelling to a completely new and different demographic audience. In other words, children, young people who would not necessarily watch motor racing on television. And secondly, that we could create marketing collateral over and above driver appearances. Because the problem with driver appearances, if you have superstar drivers like Button and Alonso, then, you know, you're constantly trying to negotiate, okay, I'm only going to pay you 12 million only, but that means you've got to do a few less marketing days. Or you must do more marketing days. And then he'd say, well, in that case, I need 18 million. So all this would go on. And you'd end up with a contract which the drivers had agreed to a certain number of marketing days, but then the sponsors would require more marketing days than there are available. This exists in Formula One now. It exists in every sport. For sure, it exists with, you know, top-class footballers and tennis players and everybody else like that. Anyway, so what we realized is that we could create from one day of, for instance, Lewis Hamilton or Fernando Alonso or Jenson Button's time, we could create a number of episodes of Tuned. So in a sense, we were not only taking the story to a new demographic, but also very, very efficiently utilizing the available driver time to create extra assets, marketing assets. And the drivers enjoyed it. They actually thought it was quite fun. When they saw the results, they were quite pleased with it. And they thought that's such a little bit more fun than, you know, just being interviewed on stage by a marketing executive in a suit or sitting down and doing another press conference. So it was a clever idea. And it was John Allott who convinced Ron Dennis personally. And Ron was a bit skeptical at first, but when he saw it, he got it. And then he wanted it to be as good as it could be. And I have to say, I mean, it won awards for creative treatment of sponsorship assets in sport, and rightly so. Very clever.
Why was it stopped then?
Well, it was incredibly expensive.
Okay.
Incredibly expensive. Animation is not cheap. And, you know, the drivers were, if you like, free, but the other actors were paid actors. But animation is expensive. It was not a cheap thing to do. And I can't exactly remember when it was stopped or who decided that was the end of it. I can't remember. John would, of course, remember, but he's not on our podcast, so I can't remember. But eventually it would have been, we've done it, that's enough, it's a bit expensive, we'll stop. And I can't remember who made that decision.
Das war der zweite Teil unseres Interview-Dreierpacks mit Matt Bishop hier bei Starting Grid, dem Formel-1-Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Nächste Woche Montag geht's weiter, um 6 Uhr kommt Teil 3. Da wird's dann, glaube ich, für viele am interessantesten sein, muss ich sagen. Das war auch das, was so ein bisschen auch der Aufhänger unserer Verabredung war. Wir sind dann so auch über seine Karriere gegangen, dass wir dachten, okay, das hat einen ganz eigenen Teil verdient. Es geht natürlich um Lewis Hamilton. Den hat er sehr lange begleitet, mit dem hat er sehr eng zusammengearbeitet und ihr werdet nächste Woche eine Geschichte hören, die vielleicht Lewis Hamilton beim ein oder anderen von euch nochmal in einem anderen Licht dastehen lässt, und zwar in einem sehr viel positiveren. Dann sprechen wir über das Thema Diversität, Homophobie, Diskriminierung im Motorsport, denn Matt Bishop war seinerzeit der erste Offizielle in einem Formel-1-Team, der sich geoutet hat als homosexuell, und er musste sich Anfeindungen widersetzen sozusagen, er musste ihnen entgegentreten, das hat er auch gemacht. Und was er dazu zu erzählen hat, wie auch die Formel 1 jetzt die ganze We Race As One-Kampagne und so führt, da könnt ihr euch auf seine Meinung auch sehr freuen. Und wir sprechen über die W-Series und wir sprechen über sein Buch The Boy Made the Difference. Den Link dazu findet ihr in der Episodenbeschreibung. Ein ganz tolles Buch, sehr inspirierendes Buch, was zu 100% an eine Stiftung geht, die im Ehren seiner verstorbenen Mutter läuft. Ein Herzensprojekt von Matt Bishop, das wir gerne unterstützen möchten. Also wenn ihr schon Richtung Weihnachten denkt und vielleicht das ein oder andere Geschenk noch braucht und damit auch was Gutes tun wollt, dann schaut in die Episodenbeschreibung auf den Link zum Buch The Boy Made the Difference. Könnt ihr dann auch auf einem YouTube-Clip so einen kleinen Teaser dazu mitbekommen, Inhaltsangabe und so, steht alles dann auf dem Link. Klickt gerne an, sichert euch gerne ein Exemplar und tut damit was Gutes. Und damit machen wir Schluss für heute. Nächste Woche Montag dann Teil 3 mit Matt Bishop und natürlich im Laufe der Woche die Vorschau auf den großen Preis der Eifel auf dem Nürburgring, das Ganze dann hier in der regulären Ausgabe von Starting Grid, dem Formel 1 Podcast auf meinsportpodcast.de. Bleibt uns treu, bleibt uns gewogen, bleibt gesund und bis zum nächsten Mal gilt wie immer nur eins, keep racing.
Starting Grid, die Formel 1 Show mit Kevin Scheuren und Ole Waschkau in Zusammenarbeit mit motorsporttotal.com und formel1.de.
Keep racing
auf meinsportpodcast.de.